Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And I know you're all looking forward to the eclipse. I hope you have good, bright weather. It's going to be quite a moment. In the old days, people used to jump out of windows or drown themselves or run through the streets if the end of the world was coming. It'd probably be right, but it's hard to anticipate. I think of William Blake, who said that he saw the universe in a grain of sand. So if you don't get to see the eclipse, just see what you can make of the grain of sand. Or slip out in the desert sometime late at night and look up at the sky. And if you want a feeling of awe, it'll be there. And I do recommend our West, the Plains. When you go to the west of North America, the desert regions, you know you're on a planet. Believe me, you will say to yourself, wait a minute, this is not quite where I thought we were. This is the Taylor Report, CIT. We're going to be talking a little bit later about developments in the auto industry with Tony Lea, as we often do. There are some big stories. There's the organization drive that is being launched in the American South, which has always been a tough nut to crack. And we'll see if there's anybody who can do it. It's the United Auto Workers with their new philosophy. They're going. And when I say new, it's the old philosophy of class-conscious organizing and relying on the people and rather than investing in NGOs and whatever it is that go out and lecture people. They are relying primarily on the workers themselves. And it certainly paid off creating a new leadership at the UAW. With a completely different approach. So we'll be talking about that, as well as the hiccup in the rollout of electrical vehicles. We're hearing Ford is slowing down its idea when they're going to be able to start production, moving it back. I understand a year. We'll get Tony Lea's expert information on that. It's certainly I think it should be a big story. But the big story for us today on the Taylor Report was that it is April, and we're in the early, the 8th, and we're having the old issue of what happened in Rwanda 1994, and it's being misrepresented, in my opinion. I mean, putting it mildly, and everyone's talking about the lessons we need to learn. One of the things we need to notice is that it is not 30 years ago, but it is right now, that the political struggle of Rwanda is continuing, that an army seized power in July 1994, an army, and the leader of that army has not relinquished power to anyone, has the country in a tight grip. And there are many, many people who thought there was going to be a political resolution and that there was going to be a society, a multi-party society in which all elements and ethnic groupings, religious affiliation, etc., would be free to participate. That is not the case. And there's a sidebar story which is prevailing at the moment, which is at this time of each year in April, arrests are made in the NATO countries, I would say largely, and they pick up Rwandans and make a show of it, as though to say, you see, the struggle of the current leader and his group is continuing, and the NATO states are, whatever their criticism of Paul Kagame, they are showing that they are trying to help him and to keep alive the story, basically a false narrative, for what occurred in Rwanda in 1994. Now, we said on the show last week that Eric Shimiyi had been arrested in Ohio, and Eric is an American citizen. He has been very accomplished in his academic background. He became an engineer with Goodyear, and has a family, and he's a decent individual who's a member of his community, known by all. And by the way, as a man who's always been in the open about who he is and what his background, he left Rwanda when he was about 20 years old. And in 2017, a fellow Rwandan of the same, roughly the same age, was charged and they brought April into it. I don't know if they charged him in April, but they definitely convicted him or made the sentencing an April date, so as to say, you see, we're in solidarity with the great narrative created by the army that conquered power in July 1994. And the individual, basically, the word genocide is used and crimes alluded to. However, the basic issue that they for which they charged that individual in Boston in 2017, had to do with immigration, because what they immediately do is to say the individual falsified his story. And Eric Shimiyi he is a man of integrity. He's a devout Catholic, and he thought it was his duty to go to Boston and testify on behalf of his friend. There's nothing secretive about it. Neither of these individuals were avoiding public disclosure of who they were. They've never made any secret of their past, because their past was part of the Rwandan story. So, as a result, now, these years later, again, I'm reminding you, they come in April, and they're making a case and smearing the name of Eric Shimiyi. My understanding is he may be transferred to Boston sometime soon. I hope that is not the case. I don't understand why they don't immediately get bail, by the way. These are presumed innocent people. There was never any charge brought against them by the United Nations Tribunal for Rwanda, and they scoured the countryside, collecting names and attempting to characterize the events that took place in Rwanda and to name those individuals who may have been involved in the violence of 1994, but it did not include the name of Mr. Eric Shimiyi. So what we have is a kind of a tragedy. The UN Tribunal did not accuse Mr. Shimiyi, nor the individual, by the way, who was prosecuted in Boston. So that was 30 years ago that these events happened. There has been in Rwanda a thing called gachaka, a sort of a very peculiar not a proper legal setting. You don't have defense lawyers and such, but they investigated themselves and they had charges brought up. This was done across the country. Many, many people went to prison. Eric Shimini was not ever accused there. His name has been on nobody's list. But because they, I guess, began to exercise their rights as citizens and as people who had been part of the Rwanda tragedy, they did have opinions. And somehow or another, this rankled, I assume, the leadership in Kigali. And so, and it becomes part of the annual April story to say, well, we found some more. This is becoming quite wicked, this exercise. And we can add to it now a case in Belgium, that of Mr. Bonampeka. Stanislaus Bonampeka has been charged in Belgium. He's in custody, and he, I would tell you, is one of the more interesting cases that you could ever look at. He was a member of the Liberal Party of Rwanda. He was an opponent of the government of President Habyarimana, the one who was assassinated on April the 6th, 1994. Stanislaus Bonampeka had been the Minister of Justice in a coalition government which was formed after 1992. And I hope I'm not startling you with just simple facts, but because the narrative, if you follow it in Canadian journals, in the Associated Press, Reuters, and New York Times and others, they portrayed President Habyarimana as the absolute dictator. But in the years from 1990 on, but particularly 91, 92, Rwanda moved towards multipartism. And they had agreed through various meetings, most famous, most of them taking place in Arusha, Tanzania. They usually have the name Arusha affiliated to them. Some took place in Belgium. But they created a multi-party cabinet. And the cabinet, as you would expect, wasn't the happiest group of people, because the way they did it was to say, well, until we can have a proper election and form a government under a party that could be called democratically elected, all those parties who have some have become established in the population, those parties will select leaders to serve in the cabinet. So Stanislaus Bonampeka was a representative of the Liberal Party, and he was a critic of the president of the country. He was at odds with President Habyarimana's party, the MRND. I would say that's fair enough. That's who he was. He, as a lawyer, he represented people who had been accused of, by the Habyarimana government, accused of collaboration with the armed groups that had entered the country in 1990. October 1990, the RPF began its armed offensive against the government of Rwanda. As you would expect, civilians get caught in you could call it a crossfire, because there's always the issue, well, where are your loyalties? And many Rwandans were accused, some rightly, no doubt some wrongly, of being affiliated with an armed group that had entered the country. And there was an arrest of a large number of Rwandans. And as a lawyer, Mr. Bonampeka represented those who were accused of aiding and abetting the Rwandan Patriotic Front. And that's a undisputed fact. And yet, here we are in a situation where now, after leaving the country, because Mr. Bonampeka seems to be a man of personal integrity, went into exile. No one, this is 30 years later, no one has accused Mr. Bonampeka. And out of the blue, this April, in order to be part of the big festival of remembering, which is a false memory created by the RPF, anybody that they pick out that they don't like can now be accused 30 years later of, in this case, an absolutely absurd charge. And the Belgians are the ones bringing the case. So this tells you, I hope, that the crisis of Rwanda has not ended. There is a fairy tale that, okay, there was a battle for power in 1994, and the RPF won, and now we all live happily ever after. And all we have to do is every year celebrate the fact that the RPF won and persecute anybody who was on the losing side and accuse them of hideous crimes. Involved in this, and I would say maybe the reason they do this is it's covering the ongoing crimes committed by the Rwandan government now under Paul Kagame. Primarily that of invading the neighboring state of Congo and holding on to eastern Congo, either directly under the Rwandan army or their proxies, a group called M23. And this is undeniable that the M23 element has been armed and taking advantage of the world's neutral view or supportive view of the government of Rwanda. In eastern Congo, as I said on the program last week, and everyone should remember, it's a mineral-rich area. It has the largest amount of the coltan, which is you need in order to have a mobile phone. So you can thank the Rwandans for going to eastern Congo and taking the coltan on behalf of Western companies, I guess you could say it, put it that way. The world actually at this point, we should remind everybody, at this point is actually in agreement that M23 as an armed group is illegally in eastern Congo and should withdraw. And there has been unity struck between Congo, Burundi, and Tanzania. So there's a crisis in East Congo. And the M23 is not prepared to go quietly. And this element of of Rwanda's behavior is not remarked on. Instead, everybody talks about it. The period of the seizure of power by Paul Kagame. But by doing that and celebrating it, they're overlooking the fact that he invaded Congo twice. The first time, they destroyed refugee camps in Congo. Those were United Nations overseen camps. and they made direct assault on them. And the world applauded the attacks on those camps because they portrayed them as an attacks on extremists. You might hear in that story a little echo of what is going on in Gaza, because you can think about it. The excuse for taking over something that doesn't belong to them is that they're looking for terrorists. But meanwhile, they're destroying the population and moving it. And I'm telling you clearly, that is what happened to the refugees. In each case, by the way, we're talking about refugees. That is what happened East Congo. They attacked a United Nations refugee camp, and Canada, United States applauded the attack, and they said that the people who were legal refugees, in fear of their lives, would have to go back under force of arms by the minority army of Paul Kagame, and then. They weren't satisfied with that. They decided to go all the way to Kinshasa and overthrow the government of Congo. That's what we got to remember. If you're going to talk about April the 6th, you're going to talk about the lessons learned. Well, the lesson we have learned is that we have been lied to, and people are still lying to us about what the true motive of the RPF has been, and that this business of arresting people in April in Western countries is simply show trials. It's only for show. It's to say, you see, the bad guys are still out there. So in this case, Mr. Bonimpeka, who was an opponent of the Rwandan government, is now the villain. He must feel painful irony to be in such a situation. But we're going to be talking a lot about Mr. Bonimpeka. I think that many, many people are going to rally to him. And I think they're going to rally to Mr. Shimiyi, because the game is getting old of manipulating the alleged criminality of individuals in order to protect and support the government of Rwanda. I believe Tony Leah is on the line. Are you there, Tony?
I am. Can you hear me okay, Phil?
I can hear you pretty much okay. This is the best we can do, and we're glad to have you. Tony, hey. I'll remind everyone, is with Unifor. He is from one of the most famous locals, the Oshawa local of General Motors. And is it 222, if I get the number?
It is. Two, yes.
Did I leave a two out? Anyway,
no.
All right. Tony, we want to ask you about, you've been following closely dynamic development in the labor movement, which is rarely are we talking about dynamism, that is growth and new ideas and such. And the United Auto Workers has a new leadership. It was the first time they've ever had the elected by popular vote as opposed to the old system. And they've set a new course, and with great success, as you've reported on this show, particularly in winning a new contract and adding a very healthy, sort of, I would call it, socialist flavor to the way they talk about the world. They talk a great deal about class and such, and also reminding the labor of its origins and what it's supposed to be trying to accomplish or should be. So anyway, it brings me to this. I understand that they have decided or have a strategic plan to try to organize in the most difficult states in America, the southern states, which all have right-to-work laws, which is, of course, what they mean by right-to-work is non-union. I'd give you that. What is going on there?
I think you've identified exactly what is happening, which is that the UAW, immediately on concluding very good contracts with the traditional big three automakers that improved wages and challenged a lot of practices, including starting to raise the idea of a 32-hour work week for 40 hours pay, and having a contract that's going to expire on May the 1st in a few years, and as a May Day event, and urging other unions to rally around that idea. All of these exciting ideas were then translated into an organizing effort to take on the non-union auto manufacturers in the United States. And I don't know how many people realize that about half of the vehicles that are assembled in the United States are assembled in factories where there is no union, and by companies like Volkswagen and Toyota and Mercedes. And there's about 150,000 auto workers who are members of the UAW. There's about 150,000 auto workers who are not members of a union. And wow. Sean Fain and the leadership of the UAW said that that's what they were going to turn their focus to. Yes. They've allocated resources and people. But more than that, they have, they've said they're not going to do it in the old way, which has been dismally unsuccessful for decades. They're going to try new approaches. So the one key factor is that they're going to rely on the workers themselves. They want the workers themselves in these plants to take the lead and do the organizing.
What a remarkable idea.
It couldn't be remarkable, but it is, because it's exactly the opposite of what has happened for a long time. And the other thing that they did is that they announced that, I think there's 14 different companies that assemble vehicles in the United States with no unions. They said they were going to go after all of them at once, not one at a time, not focus on one of them, but all of them.
Uh-huh.
And they challenged workers in all of those companies to step up, or stand up, is the phrase they've been using, and start organizing. And within just a few weeks, they had over 10,000 union cards signed in those companies, and approaching to majorities in a couple of them. And they said that what they were going to do is announce when they hit the 30% mark, and when they hit the 50% mark, and when they had 70% of the workers signed up, then they would apply for votes. And mm-hmm. they've already applied for two votes. One of them is at the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where there's 4,300 workers. And 4,300, yeah. And that vote is taking place April 17th to 19th, so just a little over a week from now. And they're going to count the votes and announce the result on the day that the Labor Notes Conference opens in Chicago, which is fortuitous overlap. Because, you know, the idea of, you know, promoting rank-and-file organizing and unions and rank-and-file initiative and mm-hmm. class struggle approach has been associated with Labor Notes for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to be at that conference. A lot of people from a lot of different industries in the United States and Canada and even internationally will be there, and will be there when they announce the result of that vote. I'm very confident they're going to win that vote. At the same time, they've announced that they've applied for a vote at the Mercedes plant in Alabama. It's in Vance, Alabama, where there's 5,000 workers.
Those are big plants.
These are big plants, and if they win them, those are substantial numbers to be organizing. And it'll just be the start, because I think that winning even one or two plants will then really expand the initiative, the momentum in all of the others. And what they're taking on is this idea that has been established for a long time, which is that taking advantage of anti-union laws, like you mentioned, the right to work laws, that companies would establish manufacturing in the south of the United States in order to be able to lower wages and have worse working conditions for workers and impose that on them because they didn't have unions that could take that on. Mm-hmm. And the UAW has been very clear that is what they're attacking, that they want workers in that region to be able to have the same respect and recognition and benefits and wages as anywhere else. Mm-hmm. It's called saying they're going to get rid of the Alabama discount.
Is that what it's called?
That's what they're calling it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because the governor of Alabama, Kay Ivey, said that she was opposed to this organizing drive because she said the Alabama model for economic success is under attack.
What party is she with? Is that it's a woman?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
She's a Republican.
Okay.
And the response from Sean Payne, the international president of the UAW, is that she's damn right it is.
Uh-huh.
He said, when she said that the model for economic success was under attack, he says, she's damn right it is. It's under attack because workers are fed up with getting screwed. And, this is a complete reversal from the approach that the former leadership of the UAW took, which was to talk about how they could get along with the corporations and, they weren't going to upset the apple cart. And not surprisingly, that never inspired workers to want to join.
If the apple cart did not get upset. If
why should they bother? There's a nice quote. Labor Notes has been writing about this a lot. There's a nice quote in the Labor Notes article by Luis Feliz León, and he quotes one of the organizers in the Alabama plant named Kimbrell, and Kimbrell says that he prefers Fain's approach of being adversarial, and he says people see that and they're like, yeah, we don't want to hold hands. We'll tell them, the management, what you're doing is wrong. We don't want that. We want this.
Yes.
And we're the work. So, yeah, we're not your friends.
Yeah. By the way, anybody taking a poll of those leaving the workplace would know that is the opinion of any worker anywhere who's under, who's being robbed of the value of his labor, he or she is being made to work under conditions that are dangerous and having bills that they can't pay. They really don't like management that much. So this idea of a partnership with them, how could it ever have been appealing?
Of course it was not,
it's just a charade. By the way, we're speaking to Tony Lea, Unifor, General Motors. How is the state, well, you mentioned the governor, but see, when you come to the point where you're talking about, okay, you got 70%, so then what happens? Is the state going to, I would assume they're going to cheat or try to keep, help management to keep the union out. Do you know how they intend to react?
Well, the local government, the mayor, the governor, and the business community are all ramping up the threats and the, raising the idea that the plants might close and the traditional things they do. Apparently, yes. They have billboards up all around the plant. I think it's going to fall short this time. The vote is supervised by the federal Department of Labor. I don't think that the state can interfere much other than trying to scare workers, and that has worked in the past.
What is it they'll try to do? Find what?
Scare the workers. They're going to try to scare people.
Yes, a fear campaign. Yes.
A fear campaign. And that has worked in the past. I don't think it's working this time from what what I'm reading.
Yeah. Now, we have, you could point out, I mean, we do have comparable kind of problem here, right? It's interesting that it's almost a balance between, you're all building cars, but half of the people building cars are not in the union, you said in the States. And what percentage
and
here?
It's true in Canada. It's very, very much the same in
comparable
Canada.
Comparable numbers.
50-50. Toyota and Honda are the big non-union auto assemblers in Ontario. And they have, I think, as many or more workers as GM, Ford, and Stellantis. And, you know, it's kind of a tipping point. It could go one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Initially, the whole success of the UAW back in the 1930s was to organize the whole industry and establish equal wages and conditions and pensions and
And if you don't do that, the non-union people are a mortal threat to the union. I mean,
always, right?
And yeah, so that has to be settled.
Original,
it's all of us or none, as the saying went.
All of a sudden, that was the original strength of the UAW. That's why and how the UAW became established in Oshawa, is that it was part of the industry. And so the workers in Oshawa wanted to be part of that union that was winning gains for people, and the union wanted them to be part of it, the international union.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have more and more non-union plants, of course it's a threat to the ones who are still unionized. And we were at that tipping point, the 50-50 tipping point. It looks like, to me, that the UAW is now finally pushing back, and they're going to it's going to tip the other way in favor of the union.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, boy, we're going to watch that very closely. And now I have to ask you about this development. They say that Doug Ford and Trudeau are a little bit shocked to learn that Ford has decided it has to move back its date for production of electrical vehicles by, is it a year, 2 years? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's 2 years. So the
2 years.
Of course, 2 years. The Ford Motor Company has been promising for a few years now to convert the assembly plant in Oakville to electric vehicle production. The plan that they announced when they negotiated the last contract last fall was that they were going to shut down for 8 months to do that conversion. That during that period of time, they were going to provide income supports for the there's about 3,200 workers covered by the contract in Oakville.
Mm-hmm.
And just this past last week, Ford announced that they were not going to complete launch the electric vehicle production in 8 months, but they're going to in 2025, but they're going to push it off to 2027. So it's a 2 year delay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's completely up in the air what income supports will be there for those workers affected, because now instead of being out of work for 8 months, they're going to be out of work for 2 years and 8 months or something along those lines.
And it's bound to be attrition. Their lives are disrupted.
Totally.
Sure. Yeah.
Totally.
By the way, you say there's 3,200 workers now. With the electric vehicle, don't they anticipate it's going to be fewer?
They have not said that. They've actually said they expect that the same number of jobs will be there.
Uh-huh.
They've said that they're going to include some battery assembly jobs, I think. But we don't know the details. And one of the things I think workers in the auto industry know is to not trust what management says anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the lessons of what's happening with Oakville right now, is that the decisions are being made by corporate executives, headquartered in the United States, by the way, not in Canada, on what they think is best for them, for their bottom line, for their profits, and for their shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as they are the ones with the power and control, those decisions continually get made in their interests, and which are not the same as the interests of workers. And so you know, that is why there's such a need for unions that understand that and are always prepared to fight those corporations tooth and nail, you know. You trust them, and you can't rely on them to care about the workers.
Yeah. It's a very troubling, you know, because one, if you're slightly paranoid, which we're all supposed to be, you wonder, you know, most of the leaders we have, currently there's an uprise in let us be carbon, let's get oil and gas, let's do what we do best, to pump it and move it and dig up oil sands. And the word electrical really bothers some of those people. This phenomenon of the electric vehicle, I know you're one of the people who've been prophesying that it's going to roll in whether anybody likes it or not. But there seems to be a strong undercurrent in our political and capitalist culture that doesn't want to see the future.
You're right. And that is a big factor in what's going on. And there's lots of people out there saying, see, we told you, you know, electric is not the way to go. The problem is that it's short-sighted. And we know that GM and Ford, Stellantis, are putting their money into producing the vehicles where they can get the highest profit today. They understand that eventually there's going to be electric vehicles, but they always hedge their bets, and they always make decisions that might be more profitable for the short term and not necessarily for the long term. And I think that they are really putting themselves in jeopardy because, you know, they're putting all their eggs...
putting the rest of us in jeopardy.
And all the rest of us, yeah. They're shifting more of their investment into producing very fancy pickup trucks and SUVs that...
when I watch them in the commercials, they're all out seeing if they can destroy the fish and wildlife and forests by spinning trucks on hillsides. A wonderful contribution.
With the price tags of $75,000 or $100,000 or more, and meanwhile, in other parts of the world where different factors figure into the investment decisions and production decisions, such as China, for example, we have companies that are producing electric vehicles that are affordable for people by the millions.
Yes.
You have a company called BYD, which last year became the largest selling vehicle manufacturer in China, surpassing Volkswagen, about 3 million vehicles. And they're marketing an electric vehicle for under $10,000 U.S.
Under $10,000?
Yes.
Under $10,000, and it's a good vehicle.
Yes. And it's a serviceable vehicle. It's, you know, it's not...
What workers call transportation. That's my transportation.
Yes. Which is why it's selling, you know, and they have a big vehicle market in China. Mm-hmm. You know, people who have outdated views of what life is like in China may not recognize the fact, but in the United States last year, 15 million vehicles were sold. In China, it was 30 million. Mm-hmm. And most of them were produced in China. Mm-hmm. So they're really primarily producing for their domestic market. Of course, there's export, and there's probably going to be growing export.
Now, by the way, I have to ask you about, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just have to point out, Trump is helpful because he's just such an amazing, flagrant, noisy person, but he says he's worried about production electrical vehicles in Mexico, and he's saying none of them will cross the American border. What is going on with the Chinese vehicles in Mexico?
BYD, the company I just mentioned, is planning on building at least one assembly plant in Mexico, which will then qualify them under
the free trade agreement,
the new trade rules that Trump helped negotiate for duty free status and import, you know, export to Canada, the United States. It's all part of the North American deal now. So I don't know how that's going to play out, but you know, BYD and other Chinese companies are very interested in starting production in North America. For the same reason that Toyota, Honda, Volkswagen, and so on did, you know, a number of years ago, for access to the market. But it.
What would be the price of those cars? Would you estimate?
Oh, I mean, I don't have any way of really.
Somewhere, as far as I know, the basic product is somewhere around $10,000. They're certainly not beyond, and not. It's not in a stratosphere of price which North American vehicles are.
Well, One thing I should point out is that wage costs in China are higher than in Mexico. Workers in China make more than auto workers in China make more than auto workers in Mexico. So, you know, it's not like they're moving to a higher wage area.
It could be very interesting to see what the wages will be.
Yep. Yeah. It's going to be disruptive. I think that's the one thing that we can say is that it will be disruption to the industry, to the auto industry. It's already disruptive. Chinese assembled vehicles have about 20% of the market in Europe already, because they are much lower priced. They're not $10,000 in Europe. They're in the range of $20,000, but they're not getting
still represents a saving,
a huge savings. A huge savings, and they're not getting more expensive; they're getting cheaper. There's a new company, a newer company called Wuling, and they make the Wuling Hongguang Mini vehicle. They sold a million units of it last year, and the Wuling Mini starting price is under $5,000 U.S.
Wow, it's just. That's the future. I guess we have to say kind of cold-blooded political things. The American model of response to this phenomenon of other countries developing and producing things is to go into a Cold War mode and say, you're my enemy and I'm not going to let you succeed with anything. And we have a trade partner called Mexico, and they didn't attend the meeting where that decision was made, and they don't seem to be frightened of China at all.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Actually, they're rather welcoming. Now that we're in North America with Mexico, you would think occasionally someone might point this out. They're not a member of NATO either, and they don't think they have to have 2.5% defense budget. And invest in war. Tony, it's been very enlightening. We thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Phil.
Okay. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I think we have a little banjo music, and then we'll come back and close up. Thank you. And we're back at Sailor Report, CIT 89.5 FM, and that was Flattin' Scruggs. And why don't we mention Earl Scruggs, who was the more talented of the two, in my opinion. Because I say that because he and Flat were really tight and great musicians. But the Vietnam War came along, and the children in the Scruggs family went to their dad and started talking about it, and Earl Scruggs became anti-war, and he's from the South, and as you know about the South, there's a struggle going on all the time there between people who want to romanticize the Confederacy and romanticize race and engage in racism and wave flags to cover up their crimes, and so there was a difference of opinion. That happened everywhere. I take a good look at Merle Haggard. Merle Haggard began by singing the Okie from Muskogee to try to create fights between young Americans. He later decided that was a mistake. But we sometimes you look at these this cultural phenomenon and you learn how painful change is. And anyway, that was Flattin' Scruggs. I mentioned earlier we were talking about the Rwanda matter. I want to make sure we say some things here about how dangerous the world is that we're in and how inept and useless Canadian foreign policy is. This about a week ago now, the government of Israel, the military, openly, nakedly, with a missile, struck an embassy, the Iranian embassy, in Damascus, killing Iranian personnel. They always like to say, well, one of them was military, or two of them. It actually has nothing to do with it. They were in an embassy. It's a sovereign, Syria is a sovereign country. And yet they gave themselves permission, Israel did, to attack an embassy. And Canada doesn't say anything about this, which means they don't have principles. I mean, they would say it if they thought, if it was in the interests of NATO or the United States, and someone entered an embassy somewhere else, Canada would put on a big show of arguing for international law and respect for protocols and all that. But they said nothing, did not complain at all. And frankly, the more dangerous aspect of the current fighting in Gaza and southern Lebanon and also involving Yemen is the spreading of the conflict. And it has been argued that probably correctly, that Israel has been looking to try to divert this into a discussion about Iran. Iran is also a sovereign government. It is a member of the United Nations. And it has friends and alliances like other countries all over the world. It is a simple rule that you don't blow up embassies in a third country, by the way. I mean, it wasn't even an attack on Iran. It was an attack on an embassy in Syria. And the dangerous part that I'm referring to is that the lawlessness is tolerated and not remarked on by the Canadian government, which makes Canadian government complicit in this. The Syrian government also has to deal with a U.S. Army base. I guess a base is a kind of a advanced word for what they're doing, but a U.S. military presence in northeastern Syria. And again, Canada, which claims to care about sovereignty and borders, and if they talk about Ukraine, they're absolutely sacred, but they don't seem to think the borders of Syria are sacred. But they are, actually, certainly protected by international law. The territorial integrity of Syria is part of its guarantee under the United Nations Charter. But the Americans, without any compunction or legal right, have made a military presence there. And as usual, they use the terminology suggesting that if they're fighting terrorism, it's okay. And actually, it's not. The U.S. has given itself license. So I would say you can forgive Israel in a sense because it is a junior partner or an attachment of the U.S. and Britain. All of them are quite intimate with each other. And so they think among them that they can ignore sovereignty of other countries. They think they can ignore international law. And they can just say, oh, we're fighting terrorists. And that will lead to war if that isn't checked. And I'll throw in now, we have the case of the Mexican embassy in Ecuador. The Ecuadorian government, which has gone from being sort of moderate liberal into whole hog right wing, they had a political leader who went to the Mexican embassy and asked for asylum, and they took him in, and the Ecuadorian army went into that embassy and violently removed him. And I haven't seen any complaint from the Canadian government to that really arbitrary, dangerous behavior. So what we're dealing with is hypocrisy and double standards. And hypocrisy and double standards will give you a bloody nose, I guarantee you that. This is the Taylor Report. I think we have reached that point where we ought to say goodbye and let you hear a little more banjo music.
CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.